Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is how my guest on today's show introduced himself when he landed his first big half-hour special on Comedy Central more than a decade ago.
My name is Sheng Wang. Sometimes when I tell people that, they're like, wow, that is perfect for pursuing stand-up comedy. I'm like, yeah, but first I was trying to pursue childhood. You know, it's tough when kids call you names. It's always worse when they just use your name. Even recently, I was making a reservation for this hotel in Arkansas. I gave the guy information, it was all good. I told him my name, I said Shane Wayne. He said, that's funny. You don't sound like that. I was like, my bad. I'm sorry if I don't meet your racist expectations. I'm sorry if I don't sound like a complete stereotype, Arkansas. You, on the other hand, doing a really good job.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was comedian Sheng Wang from his Comedy Central Presents special. It has been a long road from that promising debut in 2011 to his first hour-long special, Sweet and Juicy, which premiered on Netflix earlier this month. With his low-key style and refusal to conform to stereotypes, Sheng has flown under the radar for much of his comedy career. But that has started to change in a big way after his old friend Ali Wong decided to produce and direct his first hour, which is easily one of the funniest specials I've seen this year. So I really could not wait to have Sheng on the podcast, talk about what it's like to be in this moment and how he got here. He is such a funny and thoughtful guy, and I think you are really going to enjoy this episode. Let's get into it. Here's me with Sheng Wang. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast because I just absolutely loved your special so much, the new Netflix special, Sweet and Juicy. So first of all, just congrats on getting it out there, and very exciting.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Good morning. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's, you know, it came out this week, and... It's been a long journey, but it's been a really fun and exciting week, and I'm really pumped that people are resonating and sharing, and I'm getting responses from just all kinds of people. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, this really does feel like a long time coming for you because you've been at it for a while, and this is your first hour, which is a big deal for any comedian. But does it feel like a bigger deal almost because you've been sort of working towards it for so long?
I mean, I guess kinda. I'm still trying to understand what's going on now. Like, it's very exhilarating. But yeah, it does feel like it feels kind of like a dream come true, I guess, you know, as like crazy as that sounds or cheesy as that sounds, it feels weird. And it's currently a high, and I know it's going to pass.
Yeah. Right.
But I'm just pumped. I'm checking my messages and just seeing how people are responding to it. And it's a little bit of, I mean, I'm on social media. I'm doing like social media homework, which I usually try not to do too much social media.
what does that mean, homework?
Like just responding to people, liking people's posts, encouraging people to share, thanking people for sharing, just engaging with fans. I try not to scroll too much in social media, even though I have been, you know, I've gotten caught up in that as well. But yeah, so I'm getting, you know, that dopamine drip from checking my messages and seeing, you know, people, you know, in the inbox, and it's exciting. But I also am like wary that, like, I'm just trying to enjoy it, but I'm also wary that, you know, this is just a high that's going to pass, and, you know, life goes on.
Yeah. Well, the Netflix thing is real. I mean, I've talked to so many comedians who, you know, have really gained an audience by having specials on Netflix. You know, think of someone like Taylor Tomlinson really blew up, I think, now has two specials on Netflix. But I mean, you could name anyone really. So yeah, I mean, I think that will be, I'm sure it will have an effect on your career in that way, because so many people can find you there now who maybe couldn't find you before.
Right. It's such a huge platform. It's so crazy how big the platform is. And it's bizarre because it's like, it's happening and it's like slowly happening, you know, it's like kind of unfolding, I guess it kind of builds, and it just takes, I don't know how big this wave is going to get. It feels like it's kind of building.
I'm sure they don't tell you how many people are watching either, so that's hard.
Yeah, I mean, they're notoriously secretive, but we have a call schedule just to, I guess they will give me some sense of how
they
it's
give you
doing.
Read the tea leaves. I mean, The other person we should mention who really felt the Netflix effect is obviously Ali Wong, who directed the special, is also kind of responsible in a way for making it happen. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, absolutely. She definitely played a role. I mean, it's been such, like, we were talking about this before the pandemic, so I kind of can't recall exactly how it all went down. But absolutely, man, so grateful for Ali to be, you know, in my corner. And, you know, we've been friends since we both started in San Francisco. But she's been, you know, super supportive. And to see her do it, to see her, like, go from her first one to where she is now. And it feels kind of like it helps to see somebody do it, like a friend do it and a person of color, you know, and another Asian face do it. It made me think that it was possible, you know. I mean, I was always very, you know, pretty confident in my material and had some idea of what I was trying to do, but to see someone like her do it, and it definitely gave me, you know, inspiration, encouragement to like pursue it. But as far as putting it together, she definitely played a role, and I was so grateful that she offered to, you know, help produce and direct it, because she was so just. You know, all the little things that you never have to think about, all the little decisions in terms of production and putting it all together, like, she was just a great person to consult with because she's been here before.
One goal I've been working on for a long time, I've been working on having good posture. It's hard, dude. I don't know if I'm ever going to get there. My whole life, I have slouched because I'm super humble. I'm a good dude, you know? I see that as the default. Right? When I see somebody stand up straight, I don't believe that's natural. I feel like they're doing it on purpose. I'm like, oh, you trying to flex on me? I can do that too. I can also pretend like I believe in myself. I've slouched for so long, it feels normal. It feels comfortable. It feels like I'm sending the right message. It's like, hey, nobody hurt this guy. Nah, man, he already broken. That feels safe.
I want to really kind of dig into your story as a comedian and where you came from and everything, because I feel like a lot of people that I talk to on the show have done a ton of interviews and have sort of told their story, and I haven't really heard it from you. So can we start at the beginning? I mean, you talk in the special about how you grew up in Houston. I like the detail that you went to Beyonce's middle school.
Yeah.
Or Beyonce went to Shang Wang's middle school, I guess. but can you talk a little bit about sort of where you came from and
sure.
growing up and how you made your way towards comedy as an idea of something you wanted
sure.
to do?
Sure. Let's go back. Yeah, my parents immigrated here from Taiwan in like early 80s. I was a little child. I was like 2 or 3 years old. It was an immigrant like household. Like when we first moved to Houston, it was like multiple households, you know, my uncles and aunties and my cousins and my grandparents. Like, we were all in one house, and like my whole family slept in one bedroom. Five of us in one bedroom and with like a bunk bed and like multiple, you know, just like a whole thing. And slowly, and you know, it wasn't weird to us. We didn't know any better or know any different. It was just a fun, really like lively environment, you know, and it's really helpful for my parents because, you know, to have kids and to have multiple adults and other cousins to help take care of the kids. And it was like a pretty, yeah, it was a really fun place to grow up. I mean, that's like really, you know, before I went to school and everything. And then eventually, like, my cousins and my uncles, they moved out, and eventually, like, we ended up living in the same house that we moved in from the very beginning, and I got my own room and everything, eventually, like, in third grade or something like that. But, yeah, and then I went to school, and I don't know exactly when, but sometime in probably, like, late elementary or middle school is when you start to, like, really think about, like, maybe even before that, I don't know, unconsciously, just like how different my family is and how different it is to be not white. And, you know, and then just starting to like, and that's something I'm still trying to understand, that experience, many, many aspects of the immigrant experience. But being a child, feeling like an other, feeling on the outside, you know, it's just, it's kind of heavy and crazy, but like being, having a weird dynamic with your parents, you know, because that's your family, but at the same time, you're wary of like being different from other people, and you're kind of judging your own family, your own parents, for like not knowing how to pronounce different names of pastas at Olive Garden, or you know, or just looking different, and getting attention from other people, and going, having this weird relationship with your parents where you're like, You're kind of judging and blaming them for being different, and then you're also trying to protect them and looking out for people staring.
It's interesting because for the most part, you know, at least in this special and in other things that I've seen you do, this is not something that you really talk a lot about through comedy. I think you're really, you know, focus in on these sort of, you could call it mundane or sort of everyday things that anyone can relate to. And it's not really, it's not as much about your own personal history and experience and this kind of stuff. Is that a conscious decision for you to sort of keep that separate, or have you resisted any pressure to, you know, talk about identity explicitly on stage?
It's not really a conscious like decision to avoid it. I feel like it's like in one of my earliest sets, I've touched upon it, like my earliest TV set back in the, you know, 2006 or something, like, and there's a little bit of that at the end of the special, but, you know, I think I'm just trying to fully understand everything I'm still trying to like process what that really means to be an immigrant, a child of immigrants. So like I think when I have, you know, more to say, I'll get around to it. But I think it's just a matter of like figuring out what it is I want to say and how I want to say it. But you know, I incorporate a little bit of that here and there. Just yeah.
But it's not feels... but it's not necessarily the focus.
Yeah.
How did you start thinking about performing comedy? You weren't that young when you started, right? I mean, when did you start thinking about doing this?
It was not a childhood dream, and I was not a class clown, and I was never someone that people just said I should be, a comedian, or I was funny or anything like that. I was
Are people from your childhood surprised that you're a comedian now?
I think so. I mean, I don't think anyone suspected this would happen. I didn't suspect it would happen. You know, like I was not exposed to a lot of like pop culture. We had basic TV. We had, you know, the few channels, a handful of channels. We didn't have cable. And
you weren't watching stand-up specials as a kid in your room?
No. I mean, I was very, even like late night talk shows and stuff. Like I watched it, like there was a little bit of it, something that was interesting to me, but I didn't really understand it. And there was no one in my family that was trying to like expose me to different things like that. So it was just not really any dream or thought in mine, you know. It wasn't until like college I tried stand up for the first time. I went to a show, I went to some like little like student organized a performance, and I saw these kids doing something really, it seemed fun and exhilarating, and so I joined the group and I tried stand up for the first time in college, and it was just It went well. I mean, I was not great. I think I was basically doing some impersonation of Chris Rock.
Mm-hmm. Which is funny because you don't sound anything like Chris Rock now.
Because I just didn't have much, like, I didn't know, I didn't know what the range of comedy could be. I just thought it was, you know, I saw commercials for Def Comedy Jam when I was in school or when I was younger. And then I didn't actually watch I just saw the commercials for it. And then I saw the Kings of Comedy and I saw Chris Rock. And then that was sort of my impression, was just that. That was it. So after college, I tried it out in college. And at the time I was exploring, it was like a sort of creative, renaissance for me. Like I was like interested in exploring more creative side of myself. And I was curious with, you know, the writing and comedy and poetry and photography. And I started exploring, you know, those mediums in different classes and just on my own. And it was a very exciting time. And I think they all kind of relate to one another, you know, like they're all solo, kind of mostly solo projects, solo journeys. And it's really just about kind of examining your environment and yourself and focusing on, you know, framing certain topics or things. And so I think it kind of makes sense that those were all interests of mine. And I ended up here. Basically, my roommates at the time in college, when I started expressing interest in stand-up comedy, they introduced me. They saw Mitch Hedberg's Comedy Central special, and I had never heard of him. And they said, "You got to see this guy." And when I saw Mitch Hedberg, it changed like my whole idea of what stand-up could be. Because it suddenly felt like I could maybe do that. I could maybe just share those thoughts that I have.
What was it about him? Was it his delivery style or
it was the way he wrote jokes. It was the way he thought. It's kind of like stoner vibe. It just felt like, you know, at the time I started using pod a lot more in college and having stonery thoughts, and I always jot them down in a little notebook, you know, and I realized like he's kind of just sharing those thoughts. He's just, you know, writing it out in a way to present it and sharing it with an audience. And I when I saw that, I was like, those are, you know, I have similar things. It just made me think like I could just be myself and try to do it. Like,
yeah.
That,
so it wasn't that you were thinking I can go try to be like Mitch Hedberg. You were thinking he's being himself in a way that I can be myself.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, like his cadence, of course, was like,
infectious.
Like every you know, all the comedians at the time, was all the open mics was full of Hedbergs or Hedberg influenced people, and I was definitely one of them. And it was just, yes, it was just
did you ever get to meet him?
I saw at least one or two of his shows live in San Francisco at the Punchline, which was my home club. And then one night the last time he came to town, I was so early in my career or my pursuit, you know, I was so young in the game that the club was so packed that they wouldn't let any more comedians. I couldn't get into the club. I had come to see him because most times, you know, local comics can get in for free or whatever, but it was just too sold out. So I showed up. I had the Smokey the Bear pin that I had got from Goodwill, and I wanted to give it to him. But I couldn't get in. I didn't see him. But I stayed for the show. And that whole show, there's like this little like entrance area, a little small little area right when you come into the club, and a little table where they have the flyers and calendars, right? And I just sat underneath that table because it's right by the, you can hear everything from there. And that's where I sat there for like the hour and just listened to Mitch Hedberg and under a table. But that was the last time, yeah, he performed in San Francisco, and I never got to give him that Smokey the Bear pin.
When we were on acid, we were going to the woods, because when you're in the woods tripping, there's less likely a chance he'd run into an authority figure. But we ran into a bear. That was even more of a buzzkill. My friend Dwayne was standing there raising his right hand, swearing to help prevent forest fires.
Yeah.
We got him away from the bear. He put his arm around my shoulder. He said, Mitchell, Smokey is way more intense in person.
He's total legend. And yeah, I mean, I think his name definitely comes up, you know, when people are describing your style. But yeah, I think he's influenced a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is this sort of low-key vibe that you have that some other comedians have, but that can work really well. Is that something that you were doing right from the start? Is that just who you are? Or was that something that did you have to kind of relax into that as you got more experience?
I think that's just kind of my vibe. I'm just pretty low-key person.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I can relate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, so that was just kind of how it always was from the beginning. I'm not a fast talker. I'm not a witty, quick, you know, one-liner kind of. You know, I'm just kind of, trying to figure it out how to. You know, like I said, I was not a class clown. I was not quick with comebacks or anything like that. I was always the kind of person to be like, "Dang, what should have I said? What should have I done?" You know, just replaying that stuff back and back. You know. And so like comedy is sort of the perfect medium if you're that type of person, because you can just like figure it out what's the best comeback and then share it like a year later or whatever. So for me, that was what it was all about, was just like really a lot of thinking and like figuring it out and trying to make, you know, minimize, you know, the economy of words and minimize your, you know, cut the fat and just the lean setup for the maximum punchline and maximum impact, you know, stuff like that. Like I was really immediately I just love the creative process. I just love making something new. That was always the most satisfying thing, you know, but like, yeah. So that's all I wanted to do, was just figure out the best way to tell these jokes and to share these thoughts.
Coming up, Shang talks about the many big breaks he's had along the way, from competing on Last Comic Standing to writing for Fresh Off the Boat to the bit about avocados that more people have seen than anything else he's done on stage.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to my conversations with other stand-up comedians like Patton Oswalt, Nikki Glaser, Ronnie Chang, and more, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Shang Wang. In terms of career, was there a first big break that you got, or an opportunity that came your way that you were really excited about, or that was a big deal at the time?
I mean, every little step of the way, you know, like you start with the goal is to get a set at the local showcase, at the local club, you know. That's a 4-minute set to audition. You audition with a 4-minute set, and then if you get past, a few months later, you might get a 5-minute set or 6-minute set. And so the goals just build from there. You know, first was just to get on to that showcase. Then it was to get work as a host. Then it was to get feature work. Then it was to, you know, start headlining elsewhere, like small lower stakes places, do a college show, and then you want to just pay rent. You know, get some, just be a professional comedian and make a little bit of rent money and then get a TV set, you know, get on Comedy Central. And so all those things slowly happened over time. Like the goalpost just keeps moving. After you get that thing, you want to get the next thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you got that half hour on Comedy Central, I think it was in 2011,
yeah,
which is now, you know, more than 10 years between that and your first hour.
I know.
What was that like to have that opportunity to do a half hour on TV, which is a pretty big deal at that time?
I mean, it was super exciting. It was super, super exciting. I was just grateful and pumped to do it. I was happy with it, you know. It felt really good, but at the same time, I don't think it really moved the needle in any way.
Yeah, it didn't lead to anything major?
Nothing major. I mean, I think it's just another credit, you know, another notch on your belt.
And you can put Comedy Central on the poster at the Comedy Club.
I live in Chinatown because that's where I got assigned. There's a restaurant in my neighborhood. There's a restaurant called Shang Wang, spelled exactly like my name. All my friends insist that I have to go eat there. Secretly, I agree, but I don't know why. I don't know what kind of fantasy we expect to pan out. Like, I walk in there, everyone freaks out. They're like, oh my God, it's him.
And then that same year, I saw, I didn't know about this until I was doing some research, that you won this NBC Stand Up for Diversity contest. What was the deal with that? Because it seemed like that was supposed to lead to something that I'm not sure if it did.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that the whole idea of those contests is to kind of like find talent and kind of feed this development stream, or, you know, kind of this line of, yeah, of, I... Basically, I think that's the idea of that those contests, and I won it. I was super happy to win it, but I don't, and I think I kind of still feel this way. I was grateful for it, but I was also like, I don't know what y'all want me to do. I think they want you to come to Hollywood and then write a script and, you know, make a TV show for them, right?
Yeah.
But
is that what you did, or you didn't want to do that?
I didn't want to do that. I just didn't have it. I just didn't have that. Like I said, I didn't grow up watching a lot of TV. I didn't watch most of the big things. Everybody, you know, I didn't watch Friends. I didn't watch Seinfeld, really. I didn't watch anything. So I don't have that kind of TV, like...
TV brain?
I don't have that TV brain. Exactly. And so when I, you know, I was only really interested in doing stand-up and writing jokes. So that winning that contest was like a great honor, but it wasn't... I don't think I was the right person for them.
Yeah.
You know, for what they ultimately wanted.
What about Last Comic Standing, which is a thing that I always think is very strange, that show, and it's had a kind of weird history. And I think you were on the last season that they did of it.
I think
In 2015. What was that experience like of doing a comedy competition reality show?
It's weird. It's all weird. Like, TV is weird. Reality TV is even weirder. So I'm probably not the right guy to be in there, you know?
You weren't cutthroat.
No, I'm just trying to do whatever y'all, you know, you give me 3 minutes, I'm just trying to do three minutes of jokes, and, you know, and then I'm not great with the banter with the judges. You know, some people are much better at that. And
yeah, I saw the judges included your season, Roseanne and Norm Macdonald. Did you have any interactions with them, or did they give you any critiques?
They were all really nice. They were all very supportive. I think when I got cut, right, I was in the top 10 and I didn't make the top 5 or whatever it was. I got cut after the top 10. Basically, it came down to, I think Norm had to go one way or another between me and another comic, and he went with the other comic, but they cut this part out in the final edit, but he said, this is probably a mistake. And he went with I don't know why he felt I don't know why he said that or why he felt he had to do what he didn't want to do or whatever it was. I just remember that part. But, I mean, everybody was really, most everybody, I mean, that was a long time ago, but I had a good time. It just was a weird thing to you know, a competitive comedy show is weird.
Yeah. And then, of course, despite not having a TV brain, you were hired to write on Fresh Off the Boat. Maybe that's why they wanted you, because you didn't have a TV brain.
I mean, I should have kept that in mind, because I kept feeling a lack. I kept feeling like I shouldn't be there. I kept feeling a lot of imposter syndrome. I just don't have this TV brain. I mean, I think they just wanted me to be there for, you know, for jokes and for any personal experiences. But I put a lot of pressure on myself to try to be just like one of the veteran TV writers. And it was tough. It was tough, you know. It was such a great experience. I mean, to be part of that show in particular, to be working with those folks and that showrunner, Nanashka Khan, it was such a good, like, group and a well-run show.
Yeah, you were talking about how stand-up and, you know, photography and all these things are these solo art forms, and now you're in a writer's room where you have to work with other people, which I know is not always easy for stand-up comics. What was that aspect of it like to kind of collaborate the first time?
It was a challenge. I just wasn't used to any of that stuff. Like, I've worked in an office before, but this was like a job that you cared about, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that was new to me, to be in an office corporate environment and to like have stakes and be invested in that. And it was tough, but everyone was really nice. You know, I think all the problems that I had was self-imposed. And I got therapy after I left the show, but I should have probably got it during the show.
But it should have been during. Yeah. Was there an episode or a scene or a joke or anything that you contributed that stands out for you or that you were really proud of getting in the show?
I mean, I think one of the first episodes, and I think this is the thing, like, I felt like I was more ignorant and blissfully ignorant going in. And then I started to like find more ways that I was failing as the season went on.
Yeah, you had beginner's luck.
Yeah, I just felt like I wanted to be more than they asked me to be, I think, you know. But as far as like I had a lot of fun at the very beginning, because the first episode that they did when I was there, it was the beginning of the second season. It was like Lewis, the dad, goes on a business trip, and then the mom, what was her name? Jessica wants to like, she wanted to take the whole family. It was like a family business trip, basically. And the idea of them going, you know, going on the road and staying at a hotel, and how the whole family like stayed in one room.
Boys, remember that piece of paper your mother burned? That's something called room service. I'm going to show you how it works.
Dad, can I go to Gator World?
Of course you can. I'm in charge of the vacation now.
Woo! I want to stay here and learn room service. That's fine. I can go by myself. The park's just across the street.
I drove a bus when I was 11, so I'm fine with that. What about you, Evan?
What does it matter? Every step we take in our non-Velcro shoes is another step towards the grave.
Great, so Evan will stay here too.
That was like a big part of my childhood. You know, my family did like to travel. So we would travel, but we would like pack two families in one bedroom with two beds and then a bunch of kids spread all over the ground in sleeping bags. And we would cook like instant noodles on a hot pot. And it was a very, you know, low budget, funny, but fun, you know.
Yeah, so you were able to kind of pull from your own story for that.
Yeah, yeah. It was a lot of that. I mean, that whole, that the scene of the kids all in that same room and waking up in sleeping bags, and that was my summer in child, I mean, when I was a kid.
I think, you know, I had been aware of you as a comedian, but the first time that I feel like I really took notice was that set that you did on Two Dope Queens. The TV show on HBO, the stand-up showcase. And that, I think you really broke through in a big way on that show. And I think, and a lot of people did, because I think it was just a great platform. But what was that experience like of going on that? I mean, did you know that it was kind of going to blow up the way that it did and still lives on YouTube? And I think it's probably one of your most watched, you know, clips online, probably.
Yeah, I didn't know. I mean, I knew it was HBO, and I knew they were a popular show, but I didn't really have any, like, strong, big expectations. There was, like, a 7-8-minute set or something like that. And basically, that was towards the end of my writing stint on the Fresh Off the Boat show. So I was ready. I was trying to gear up and go back to stand-up comedy, and I was feeling, you know, I was slowly writing jokes during that time as a TV writer. It was hard. I couldn't really maintain the usual pace I had before. But I came, when I got that offer to do that set, I had at least that time. I had at least like 10 minutes that I really felt strong about, you know. And so when they gave me that slot, I just was excited to do it. And I felt super confident and ready. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you kill right out of the gate with that avocado bit, which was a big one. How did you decide to open with that?
It just felt like that. Like, that joke just felt like it always resonated with people. Like, it started as a tweet. I think I tweeted once, like, years before that. I had just tweeted, like, something about having too many ripe avocados. And then eventually it became a bit. And then, I don't know. I just felt like it was, you know, two dope queens filming in Brooklyn. It's a lot of white women in the audience, and I just figured avocado was a good way
to get
started. And it seemed like it worked, but yeah, it just felt like a good way to start the set.
I'm sorry, I'm a little stressed out. I found out I got too many ripe avocados. They just creep up on you. We love them. They're great. They're so expensive, so I buy a bundle so I can save a little bit. But you can't eat them for like 6 to 8 days. I didn't put it on the calendar. I forgot I bought avocados. You find one ripe avocado, that's a moment of joy. You find a bag of five. That's a crisis. It's different now. I can't go out and have dinner tonight. I gotta stay home and handle my business.
You know, having known you from that and other TV appearances, there is something a little surprising about how your onstage look has evolved and changed in this new special. Was that something that you thought about a lot, or was that just sort of something that happened during the pandemic, or with your long hair? And
this is totally a pandemic like accident.
You just embrace it.
Yeah, I canceled my haircut on March 12th or 11th, something like that. Like right before the lockdown.
Good decision. Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't get it cut for like a year. I wasn't planning on keeping it. I was just wanting to see how it would look. But then people kept saying nice things, and it just felt like it did look like me now. Like I feel like it's me. And people say, like, in a weird way, like it's got a weird symbiosis, like it just sort of works with the jokes and with the act. And so I just kept it. I definitely considered, you know, cutting it before I went back to doing stand-up after the lockdown. But Allie also encouraged me to keep it. She liked it. And it just seemed like people, it seemed like it worked.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about it as like actors always talk about how like the hairstyle or the costumes or the shoes or whatever makes, you know, influences the way that they perform a role, or it like helps them get into character. And I was wondering if the hair almost influences your onstage persona or changes it in any way or makes you feel different.
I think there's a little bit of that. I think that's true. I think, you know, like, yeah, like how actors put like a little pebble in their shoe, they need to be a little like,
unstable,
or whatever little thing that they do, little tricks. I think it does add a little, you move your head different. Your movements are different, you know, because the hair moves with you. So I'm learning how to have this hair. Like, I had trouble drinking from the water fountain at this museum, like, earlier, you know, last year or whatever, just because, like, I couldn't get the water.
You need someone to hold your hair back.
Yeah. I didn't know how to, like, do that. But, yeah, it sort of works. It sort of seems to be, you know, it sort of just works. It definitely is a departure from, you know, my whole career before this was trying to be as mundane and boring. And as far as my physical appearance, was to be as bland as possible. And just
actually trying to do that?
I was. I felt like that was something I learned earlier on. I don't know who or how I got there, but the idea was like just to not be distracting, to not have tattoos showing or anything like that, just to be, you know, just go on stage. That's kind of like the mindset that I have, is just to go on stage and not let the jokes kind of, you know, speak for themselves and not have things that people can kind of think about or judge me on.
You know, we talked a little bit about this earlier about the Netflix effect and getting this big platform. And obviously, you know, you saw what happened to Ali Wong when she really blew up after her first Netflix hour. Does that sort of raise expectations for you in terms of what comes next and how to think about, you know, your career moving forward? And how are you thinking about that?
I'm not thinking too far ahead. Right now I feel like my goal is to just figure out another hour. Just keep doing comedy and keep writing new jokes. I'm trying to not give myself too much pressure, although I'm getting comments of people like, can't wait to see more. And I'm like,
yeah,
just enjoy the hour
for
a little
while.
Where's
the next hour? Yeah, it's been out for a week.
I know. So I'm trying to not let that get to me, because I know that's something it's a mistake to worry about that hour as opposed to just live today and write one joke today, whatever it is, just work on the process and the craft day by day. And, you know, Ali did a lot. She wrote a book. She made a movie. She did two more specials. Like, I don't know if I can keep up with – I don't know if I can hang like that, you
yeah.
know?
Do you think about whether you would want that level of fame if it came to you, or how you would deal with it?
I mean, I'm already weirded out by just this right now. Like,
yeah.
Just getting one recognition. I went out for dinner last night, and one person was like, I saw you on the you know, they watched the special last night or the night before. And so that already kind of weirded me out. But I mean, you know, I've been on tour with her, and I've seen just how hard it is to eat lunch in public sometimes, or have your kids around, and it's part of the thing. It's part of, you know, being in this business. I don't really want that level of fame, I guess. I mean, I would like to be. I mean, I don't know how much that I can, how much say I have that anymore. It feels like it's just going to be what it is. But that's just kind of the trade-off, you know. But no, I mean, I don't really, you know, I'm not really, that's not something I want. It's just part of what comes. I rather live more anonymously, you know, that's my preference. I'm not really one to be like, unless I'm on stage doing a set, I'm not really looking for the spotlight.
So now what I want to do is our segment called The First Laugh. So I'm going to ask you a bunch of firsts in your career and life around comedy. So going all the way back to when you were growing up, I mean, you said that you were not a class clown. You weren't really a comedy fan. But do you remember the first piece of comedy that did make you laugh really hard? You know, whether it was as a kid or in college or anything that stands out in your memory?
I feel like I'll give you like three kind of moments that I remember. One is just like me hanging out with my childhood best friend, and we're climbing a tree. We're like, I don't know, 10 years old or something. We're climbing a tree and we're hanging off this branch, and my friend is comparing himself to like a roasted duck in a Chinatown restaurant window. And that just cracked me up. I don't know. These are all just like,
yeah, not professional.
No,
comedy,
professional comedy.
Comedians.
Like, again, I didn't watch professional comedy. Another memory I have is just playing basketball with my dad. Just, it's sort of like the basketball joke. Like, just being on the court, and you know, even if I just remember one time being unhappy with my dad for whatever reason. I wasn't getting something that I wanted, and I wasn't happy with him. But we went to play basketball just because it was something that we would do, and just playing hoops was just such a it just you know, killed the tension. And it was just so fun and funny to try to play basketball with your dad and, you know, have moments when those are the funniest moments for me is when your body is not doing what your mind wants to do. And that separation or difference or whatever that is, that I don't know, that's the funniest thing to me.
Do you remember the first joke you wrote that really worked, that really connected to an audience that you felt good about and could keep going back to?
I remember a few early jokes. One of them was, I mean, like, I think the strongest joke that I wrote when I was first starting out, like when I was hitting the open mic scene. This is like past that college stuff, and I was like, really, okay, let's try to see where the beginning of this journey looks like, and as a professional. And so we were just doing mics and stuff, and I think the strongest joke that kind of, like, I used it as my closer when I did Live at Gotham, but it was a play on, it was basically the setup was my friend was telling me that I could do better in regards to someone I was on a date with. So she said, you could do better. And the joke goes, I know I can do better, but better is trying to do best. Better's out there trying to do best. I'm going to be okay. I'm going to do okay. Something like that. It's a play on good, better, best. And it was a play on words, but it was also, you know, kind of dating and sexual or something, and that was one of the big banger, one of the first bangers.
Do you have a story or memory from your career that makes you laugh now, but really was not funny when it happened?
Oh, good question. I've shared this story before, but I think you know, anytime, all those bombing stories, all the times you go out there and you just eat it. You just eat it so hard. I mean, this is one. It's multiple shows that were. I mean, I'll share one of this. I don't think I talked about this too much, but I did one college show where, like, I mean, they all kind of suck. They're all kind of in the daytime in the cafeteria, or they're not even. It's just like a place where it's a hallway. There's people there's a lot of transit going on.
It's not the best environment for comedy.
Right. There's no spotlight. There's barely a PA. There's no stage. It's just like you're just like a lunatic. Doing jokes in the hallway or whatever. It's just terrible most of the time. And I remember one time I was eating it really bad. This is in, I think, Wisconsin. It's fine. Some people, there's a little bit of chuckle here and there, but you can see, there's like a handful of kids there. You can see everybody. It's just broad daylight. And I remember this one student in the front that's not enjoying the show, and that's fine, you know, but the whole time he's like this. He's just shaking his head
shaking
back
his
and
head.
Forth, left to right. Like,
it's like,
just
why are you here,
disagreeing
dude?
With everything. And I'm like, just don't laugh, please. You cannot laugh. That's enough for me to know that you don't like it. But to give me another visual cue on top of that, like, it's not necessary, dude. Those silly moments
Those tough times, yeah. So finally, I like to ask my guests, what's making them laugh right now? Is there something that you have seen recently or something that really made you laugh that you want to shout out?
I don't watch too much TV, but I did watch the whole series of This Fool. I think it's on Hulu. They dropped the whole thing. It's 10 episodes. It's great. It's written by the guys. It's made by the guys who did Corporate, I think, or some of those guys.
Yeah, yeah. They're involved. And then Chris Estrada is the creator.
Yeah, and Frankie Quinones, I think that whole series is so funny and great.
I feel like a little underrated and probably needs the shout out. So that's a good one.
Yeah, This Fool on Hulu. It's a wonderful, wonderful series. Thank you.
Well, Shang, thank you so much for doing this. Your special really made me laugh hard, and yeah, it was great to have you on the podcast and get to know you a bit better. And this was a lot of fun. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you again to Shang Wang for being my guest on this episode. He's never really done a long podcast interview like this one, so it was really great to hear so much of his story, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. Shang's hour-long special, Sweet and Juicy, is streaming now on Netflix, so definitely check it out there if you haven't already. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.